Like everything in Japan, there's a lot more nuances and cultural expectations that they don't have with their foreign clientele, which they actually quite, pardon me, they actually find quite refreshing. So they don't have to dress as tightly. Not everything is expected to have, four levels of manners attached to every transaction. You're not expected to immediately return a phone call or foreign clients, maybe because they're not using the phone as much, but also because of the time difference, are a lot more comfortable communicating via email or messaging. So you don't have to constantly with your finger on the pulse, answer the phone late at night like you do with a Japanese client. So it's a different type of clientele. There's other stuff that the various types of clientele expect that the others don't. Folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima Magen, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. So, yes, right before we get into it, the autumn session of the Japan Real Estate Summit, as mentioned, is locked in for 17th, 18th October, Saturday, Sunday at the Tokyo International Forum. And we will have those early bird forms ready for you to fill in very, very soon if you want to grab your discounted tickets. But time to start making your travel arrangements if you haven't yet. We'll also have the final list of speakers ready for you very soon, but you already know what to expect. Definitely most, if not all, of your familiar and favorite crowd pleasers, plus hopefully a few extra new ones. The absolute best in English language expertise on every aspect of Japan's real estate property market at the industry's biggest event. So mark your calendars, book those flights. They're cheaper in advance, as are hotels and Airbnbs. And we will see you all then. So, for today's episode, tons of excellent info for you, especially if you haven't yet purchased here in Japan, but also for old hands. It's a pretty long episode, but I think you'll enjoy it a lot. This is part two of the conversation that I've had recently with Maya Matsuoka of Japan Expert Insights, a consulting firm that specializes in Japanese business culture, cross-cultural management, leadership, customer experience, and business strategy here in Japan. And speaking of old hands, she's definitely one of the OGs when it comes to cross-cultural business training and leadership, and it's always a pleasure and an honor to speak with her. And in our first conversation, which we'll link to in this episode show notes, of course, we talked about the basics of the real estate market here and what are some of the things that make it different to others around the world. We briefly touched on asset classes, the do's and don'ts, the business environment, common practices, and what buyers should be aware of before pulling the trigger on the first deal. And in this conversation that you're about to listen to now, we dig in even deeper into these topics and unpack them even more. So we talk about how foreign buyers are different from domestic buyers, how local professionals here deal with these differences, how we at NTI get these traditional sellers and their agents to agree to deal with foreigners in the first place, and how part of our job is to educate foreign buyers on Japanese cultural nuances and market standards. And speaking of our buyers, what some of those typical buyer profiles are, how those have changed over the years as the market and the buyers pool both matured,
how the new business manager visa requirements might have changed these buyer profiles as well, which then led us to address the question whether it's even possible to utilize property investment for residency in Japan, and if so, how. We talk about some of the misconceptions and assumptions that many folks have when they're purchasing here for the first time. One of the main ones being the clear distinction here that isn't that distinct overseas always between holiday homes and investment properties. And when do holiday homes qualify as profitable investments, if they ever do? We discuss the international fascination with akiyas, the myth of the free houses in Japan. Is it real? What does it actually entail? We discuss speculation as an investment strategy, current market trends, the switch from prefectural and city population trends to more granular ward and inner city trends, urban rejuvenation, gentrification, how these affect property prices and popularity of various locations. We talk cash flow versus potential growth considerations and how these might affect your portfolio structuring, various property profiles, investment strategies, and who might each of these be suitable for. We discuss the art and science of successfully investing in hospitality or short-term stay properties and other alternative asset classes, sourcing, replacing, working with property managers who specialize in these various types of tenancy leases. We talk about buying old versus new, what are the sweet spots for various types of assets, how building materials and the size of the asset can and should affect your investment strategy, and why a small multi-unit building is often the best of all worlds. We also break down some of the confusing terms that are relating to various types of condo and apartment building assets, as well as how owner unions and building management companies work. We talk about buffers and reserves that are required when you own the entire structure as opposed to a condo unit. We talk investor risk appetite and global portfolio structuring, the importance of setting clear investment goals, expectations, and long-term budget allocations well ahead of any purchase. What counterintuitive market quirks the first-time investor should be aware of, and the importance of being open to learning new things when you're entering a new market for the first time. We talk about the availability of financing for both residents and non-residents, buying versus renting when you're living here, what's more suitable for who, how the market in that regard has changed over the last 15 years. And finally, what's the biggest surprise that most people face when they're buying here for the first time? So yeah, talk about deep dives. This is probably the mother of them all. Lean back, grab yourself a drink and some snacks, and enjoy the journey. I shall see you again on the other side.
And good morning to everybody watching us and to everybody who will be watching us later today or this week. Once again, I'm very pleased to welcome Ziv. Sorry, I always mistake the name and I say it's Ziv. Ziv Nakajima again, because he was here last month actually, and we couldn't finish the conversation about real estate in Japan, about myths, mistakes, and market realities, because there is so much information to share. And Ziv, I'm so very grateful to you for being willing to share that information with us, with our audiences and everybody else who is new to the podcast as well. Thanks a lot for coming this morning. I know that you're busy, and once again, welcome.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I loved our conversation last time, so it's fun to be back.
Yeah, I loved it too, and that's why I wanted also to continue it. So could you please just once again for the newcomers here, let us know a little bit about your story in Japan, and then we'll move into the topic.
Sure. So I was born and bred in Israel, kind of ran away from Israel in my late 20s, migrated to Australia, lived there for about 10 years, so dual citizenship now. And then about 15 years ago, I moved to Japan with my partner, started up Nippon Tradings International, NTI, which is a company that helps people buy, sell, and manage any kind of real estate in Japan, 100% foreigners, whether they're expats or living in Japan. For various reasons, they might need our help as well. And 4 years ago, started another company just by feedback and client request, people wanting to invest in other things, people wanting to relocate to Japan. So that's what the other company does, business M&A and relocation to Japan. I'm also just started their e-commerce business, importing fashion products and selling them online in Japan, but that's completely unrelated to anything we're discussing here.
Congratulations on that too. And I would love to hear your insights and experiences with that new business there, because it seems that quite a few people have such ideas in mind. They want to relocate to Japan, as you know, and they are thinking about what they can do, right? But that's, well, a topic of another conversation.
Correct.
So, yes, today we're going to talk about what you do in real estate and the business here. So you mentioned that you work with non-Japanese expatriates and residents, predominantly or 100%. So I wonder whether you can compare the level of difficulty of doing that as compared to working with local people, with Japanese residents, let's say, and Japanese citizens.
Only based on what our partners and colleagues who are serving Japanese clientele tell us, because we obviously don't have any of these clients. I think technically foreigners are probably more of a hassle, more mendokusai, because we tend to ask more questions. We ask for inspections. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know when we're purchasing here for the first time that could be quite different to what we're used to overseas. So there's a very high level of education and added friction related to just being a bit more detail-oriented and a bit less cluey or a bit less educated about how the Japanese market works. From what I hear from my Japanese real estate agent and professional partners who are working with local Japanese, it's a lot more, like everything in Japan, there's a lot more nuances and cultural expectations that they don't have with their foreign clientele, which they actually quite, pardon me, they actually find quite refreshing. So they don't have to dress as tightly. Not everything is expected to have, you know, four levels of manners attached to every transaction. You're not expected to immediately return a phone call or foreign clients, maybe because they're not using the phone as much, but also because of the time difference, are a lot more comfortable communicating via email or messaging. So you don't have to constantly with your finger on the pulse, answer the phone late at night like you do with a Japanese client. So it's a different type of clientele. There's other stuff that the various types of clientele expect that the others don't.
Mm-hmm. I see. And that's interesting. That's fascinating, because it's basically you're seeing the, let's say, the business from the other perspective. Usually it is like people coming here and they communicate, they want to do business with Japanese companies, and so they have to be kind of educated, right, and trained on Japanese manners and what they can say, what their expectations could be. But now, so you are seeing all that, paradigm, let's say, from the opposite direction, where in a sense it's a little bit easier, and then in a sense it's much harder when you have to, let's say, manage the cultural expectations as well, I mean, and so on. But yeah.
We work with, by nature of our work, we work with agents who are more open to working with foreigners. So there's less of what you would have. Like, for example, if somebody enters here with my other company that helps people, for example, M&A and existing Japanese business, somebody would come in here and they'd have to, again, like you'd normally have to behave correctly to get a Japanese partner to agree to work with you, to consider working with a foreign company or a foreign individual. Whereas the agents that we work with are already, and there's been more of them over the years. Japan is definitely changing in that regard. They're a lot more open to working with foreigners. So they're a lot more forgiving, but you still have a seller who is traditional Japanese and the listing agent who got permission from the seller to list the property, and they're a lot more traditional. So we or the agents that we work with on the foreigner side still have to go through the convincing, but because we're a Japanese company and the buyer side agents that we work with are also a more traditional Japanese company, it's easier to convince the more traditional side. We know like Chikako, my partner, over the years has perfected her pitch in the sense that, you know, don't worry, you won't have to speak English, or don't worry, we'll deal with everything. You'll always be able to talk to me. You won't have to talk to the scary foreigner on the other end. And don't worry, you don't have to share your commission with others. So we already preempt their hesitations and we try to answer them from the initial introduction.
Right. Yes. And that comes from experience, I'm sure, that, but as you said, you know, you do the pitch and eventually you perfect it gradually with time. So I have a question.
Well, we've been rejected so many times in the first few years that we had to. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No. Please tell us that, because that's what many, let's say, many foreign buyers do not realize, how difficult it is for the people like you, the companies like you, to establish those connections as well with the sellers here as well.
The sellers and their agents, yeah. There are obviously very hundreds and thousands of small local real estate agencies, in particularly in smaller locations, but there are some very big real estate companies with presence nationwide that handle a lot of the market in the bigger cities. And we really have to maintain those relationships, because if for any reason we're, I don't want to call it blacklisted, it's nothing as official as that, but if there's a perception of us as representing rude or tire kicking or, you know, unprofessional foreign buyers, then those companies and bigger sellers who have a lot of properties to sell will not work with us. So when this is something that we have to explain to our clients, is they're used to a situation, and I think we briefly touched on it in our first conversation, mm-hmm. They're used to a situation in Western countries especially where the buyer is king and the real estate agents will flip over backwards to make sure that the deal happens, and they're very hungry and they run around making sure, trying to please the buyer. Not the case here. So we have to do the heavy lifting and convince the buyers to work with the sellers to work with the foreign buyers. And those relationships have to be maintained. We can't just submit offers and then cancel them for no reason, or, you know, submit a bunch of inquiries and then ghost them and disappear because we're actually focused on another property now. We do any of that, then we're not going to be able to work with that company or with that seller again.
Right.
Now, if you're actively looking at property in Japan, you should check out Akiya Mart. That's AKIYA-Mart, MART, akiyamart.com. It's the Zillow of Japan, built for buyers who are actively hunting for a home in Japan and want a much more Western-style web browsing experience than the typical local Japanese websites. Now, we've got an exclusive 30% off promo code for the Akiya Mart Pro annual plan. That's the one that gives you full access to Airbnb zoning maps, hazard maps, sold data, and over 500,000 listings nationwide at any given time. So if you're serious about buying in Japan and you want an easier way to search, this is the best tool that we know of. So you can use my code ZIV, Z-I-V, at checkout and get 30% off your Akiya Mart Pro annual plan at akiyamart.com.
Right, yes. And we have seen shifts as well the people who want to relocate to Japan. The numbers are increasing, I believe. And I don't know whether the latest regulations, the change in regulations has had any impact on those numbers. But still, my question is not so much about the numbers as about, have you seen any change in the profile of people who want to relocate or who want to buy property in Japan?
Well, buying property in Japan doesn't automatically enable you or leverage your residency quest, mm-hmm. right? So you're not going to be able to buy a property and by virtue of owning a property, then get residency in Japan. It doesn't work like that here. We have had a lot of people before the latest revamp of the immigration policy for business manager visa. We have had a lot of people who were setting up tiny cafes or buying a small Akiya and turning it into Airbnb because the threshold was quite low. It was about 5 million yen plus potentially maybe one staffer, but you didn't have to. That's all changed now. So we do get more serious people in the sense of business investors, people who are starting business or purchasing a business to run in Japan are a bit more structured in what they want. They have a stricter business plan, larger capital, and they know very well what they're going to do. They got it mapped out because they have to. Those are the new regulations. But the people who want to relocate to Japan are still the people who want to relocate to Japan. So anyone who's not investing in a business, somebody who's looking for employment, somebody who's moving here with a family on various types of visas and need support on the ground because of the language or the unknowns that they need to familiarize. Those are still the same people.
Right, I see. Okay, so, and I think it's an important point, once again, you mentioned this, that being a property owner here does not add any points to your application for residency, right? So, because some people may have that misunderstanding, I believe, but that's actually not the case in Japan.
Well, for that to be a path, it has to be a much larger investment. So the minimum cap now is 30 million yen of capital to be invested in your business. It doesn't have to be immediately invested, but at the end of the first year, when it's time to renew the business manager visa, the immigration department will look at what you're doing with that capital, and they'll want to see that you are investing at least parts of it towards expanding the business or you know, getting the business on its feet. Mm-hmm. You can do this with property. So you could buy a small building or a larger portfolio of condo units or houses for 30 million and over. But unless it's a very, you have to tweak the investment. So if we look, for example, at a typical long-term residential lease semi-passive investor, which is most of our clients, who just have a tenant in there on a two-year rolling lease and constantly renewing those leases, those kinds of properties will generate, if they're lucky, maybe 6%, usually more like 5% before tax. So even if they were investing, let's say, Ichioku, 5% of that would be, Ichioku being, I think at the moment, about 750,000 US, maybe a little bit less.
Right, yeah, that's what I was calculating.
Yeah, yeah, I know the look. So, yeah. So those people would be getting, let's say, conservatively or practically speaking, about 5% return. That's about 5 million yen a year, right? Go ahead, one, which is about 30,000 US. Mm-hmm. If you're a family of three, the immigration department doesn't deem that sort of income sufficient to sustain a family of three, right? So if it's yourself and two dependents, or four, you have two kids or three dependents, that sort of salary that the company you set up will be paying yourself is not going to be sufficient to sustain a family. So 5% on 700 plus, even though it satisfies the initial requirements for setting up a business, doesn't satisfy the requirements to constantly renew it. So real estate, which is a relatively safe and stable but low yield kind of investment, is not really the best path towards residency here. If you turn it into a hospitality property and it's run like a very smooth, well-oiled machine and it's generating 10, 15% per annum, then that starts becoming a conversation. But again, most of our clients who are investing in real estate prefer to be more passive about it. So they're happier with a lower yield, but the more safe and stable and hassle-free kind of nature of the investment.
Right. So I gather that there are different kinds of investments when we talk about the real estate industry. So, and then what constitutes an investment? So obviously buying a home is not really an investment, or is it?
And then in other countries, it's considered as such. And we have a lot of people coming in talking about purchasing a holiday home and constantly referring to it as an investment. So one of the first conversations that we have with them is, let's just set the record straight that in Japan, the property is not guaranteed to gain in value. In fact, if you're purchasing it out in the countryside, it's almost guaranteed to decline in value. Mm-hmm. Declining population, the structures depreciate very quickly from a tax perspective. The land is the only thing that could gain in value. And in bigger cities, it does. But if you're buying a holiday home, you're definitely not buying an investment unless it's in a super central location, which would make it very expensive. So while overseas, the assumption is that real estate always gains in value over time, although I would probably push back on that. In many countries around the world, it hasn't been the case, depending on location and type of property. But first of all, if you're buying a holiday home, that is not an investment. To qualify as an investment from our perspective in Japan's financial economic environment, I would want the property to be generating income on a monthly or annual basis.
I see. Well, and you mentioned one of those ways, turning it into a
hospitality property.
A hospitality property, yes, thank you. Right, so it could be a ryokan, it could be a hotel, it could be an onsen, for example, open to the public. It could be anything, I believe, that...
Yes, but if it's a holiday home that you're going to be using throughout the year, it depends on how often and during what seasons you're using it, right? So if you're buying a house in Kyoto, for example, that could potentially do very well on a hospitality, through a hospitality lens, if you're using it throughout every sakura season and every red leaf season, and you're doing it and you're doing that 4 months out of the year, then you're going to be maybe covering costs when you're not using it. You're not really going to be generating much of an income, are you?
Yeah, I guess that's the case for maybe most of the properties here anyway. So and then I also have a question to you when it comes to the buyers now, and I don't want to sound discriminative or whatever, but as a buyer profile. So do you see younger people wanting to invest in Japan nowadays, or is the age higher? So how do you describe, you know, the...
For investment, so straight out investment purposes, again, putting holiday homes and such aside, people who are just looking to invest their money here and generate an income or a profit of any kind, we do see more youngsters over the year. I think particularly with tech and crypto and blockchain technologies, there are younger people with more capital on their hands, but they tend to be young professionals, right? Your typical 16 right. or 20 year old is usually not somebody who's going to have the capital right. to purchase here. Japan is a cheaper country than most, especially if you're out of the big cities, but still entry level reasonable, unless you're buying a shack in the woods, entry level reasonable kind of property is going to start at around 30, 40, 50,000 US. So those have to be, when they're young, they are professionals. The majority of them are more mature. So they'd be people in their at least late 30s all the way up to early 70s, I would say, who are already, if not savvy investors, at least have done their homework and know what they're getting into, or would like us to educate them on getting what they're getting into, but they have a financial sense about them. Yeah.
Right, I see.
But the dreamers are out there at all ages. We got people as young as 18, 20 who are looking for that shack in the woods kind of situation. They read articles about free akiyas in the countryside, and they're happy to come here and try to get something for $1,000 to $5,000 if they can. We usually send them away, but they are out there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because that was, and maybe it continues to be such a big topic online, the Japanese akiya, and of course there were rumors. I believe that some of them were given free, or others were just very, very cheap, like, as you mentioned, $5,000 or $10,000. But
it's not a complete myth. They are given free, but usually if they are given free, they're given free to somebody who's a resident of Japan and relocating with their family to a countryside town that needs the young blood kind of thing. So not for foreign people coming in without residency to buy a holiday home. They're not going to get anything for free. They can get very cheap properties, but they're essentially buying into headaches. So if you're somebody who's very, very good with your hands and very, very comfortable living out in the boonies where you're going to have zero infrastructure, zero access to any convenience, and you want to just buy a plot of land with maybe a rundown shack on it and spend the next 5 years, you know, lovingly restoring it or rebuilding it, then yes, they're out there, but a comfortable living, it's not.
Right. And well, I believe also that it kind of determines, once again, the age bracket of the people who really get such properties, because I believe that after a certain age, people do prefer to have certain conveniences and also infrastructure. And I mean, especially here in Japan, everybody's very health aware. People want to have hospitals nearby or clinics and so on and so on. So while I can see...
Supermarket would be a good start.
A supermarket too, yes. You cannot grow all your food, even though you can grow some of it, I'm sure, but not
well,
all.
We do have some customers, a very small subset of our customers who are exactly looking for that, though. They do want to be off the grid. We have people, again, not many of them, but we do have people who buy land plots in very remote locations that they think have potential to become a hotspot sometime in the future. And then they just buy a land plot and sit on it, hoping for potential, you know, for the world to discover that little town not too far from the ski slopes that no one's ever heard about yet. So they are out there, but they're not the majority of our customers now.
Right. And I still wonder, is that a good strategy? You buy something in a place which you hope the world will discover at some point in the future, because we know that business does not rest on hopes, right?
Yeah, but speculation is a thing, right? So, I mean, for example, when we started our business, we are based here in Fukuoka City. When we started 15 years ago, we saw some slight indications that made us think that this place would be would become known or go on the map, so to speak, because, you know, population trends were the reverse of what's happening in the rest of Japan. People were actually having babies here. Salaries were slightly edging upwards, which again was not very much not the case in other parts of Japan. This was back in Abe times, yeah, right after the 2011 tsunami and subsequent Fukushima disaster. So that bet worked out. People who invested in Kumamoto, where TSMC then established a very large factory these days, people who invested in some of the ski towns in Nagano that were completely unknown, you know, even up to 10 years ago, those bets worked out. So I suppose from a I'm not a speculative investor by any means. I'm way too geeky for that. I prefer something that's well documented and doesn't need any hope. But the people who speculate, similar to the people who invest in unicorn startups, right? They spread their investments, they spread smaller amounts, and if even one of those turns out well, then they've done what they came up, what they set out to do.
Right. No, that's a fair comparison, I believe. And still, I mean, when you mentioned that you chose Fukuoka because there were certain signs of the city and the area going up, then I can understand that because you based your choice on analysis, right? So the anyway, right. So
I mean, it was analysis with a very large portion of hope in there, because
okay.
When you invest in Japan, Japan is facing some very severe macroeconomic headwinds, right? The population decline, the percentage of GDP to the percentage of debt to GDP, which is second only to the USA, I think, and the fact that the changes come very slowly here because, again, of the traditional insulated nature of the country. Any kind of bets on Japan's future economy or growth are very much, from my perspective, even as somebody who does business here, are very much a speculation play.
They are indeed, yeah.
I can try to find locations within Japan that I think will do well if Japan's economy overall does well. But whether that'll happen or not is always a bit of a gamble.
Right, right. No, that's an interesting topic to talk about and think about. Mm.
Yen Loans are a sponsor of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. They're a non-bank lender offering financing to both residents and non-residents of Japan for purchases of condominiums, as well as equity release cash-out financing against properties that you already own in Japan, whether mortgaged or fully paid off. They cover all of Japan's major metro areas, Greater Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, Kobe, Nagoya, Fukuoka, and Sapporo, offering a full nationwide footprint for all of your condo purchase financing needs. No residency, incorporation, or Japanese bank account is required, and the application process is highly streamlined. They have legitimate backers, highly reputable, and I can personally vouch for their founder, Mark Drapkin. Yen Loans welcome your business. Reach out to them at yenloans.com and let them know that you heard about them on the Japan Real Estate Podcast to receive 50,000 yen off your loan application fee.
Okay, and then, so because you talk about, how the economy is currently facing those headwinds and the nation as a whole, of course, the demographic challenges and everything. So how would you describe the market, the real estate market in Japan right now? And how do you see it? Or maybe there are one, two or three scenarios that you can imagine happening depending on how the economy goes. And I'm talking from the perspective, of course, of investing in the real estate market.
Yeah. I would say that for the next few decades, at least, I try not to project anything beyond that because anything could happen, right? We got World War III, aliens, AI, robots killing us all, anything could happen. But looking forward a decade or three, let's say, at the most, and if Japan doesn't do anything drastic to combat that declining population trend, I would say that the smaller townships would keep conglomerating into the bigger cities. Mm-hmm. And within the bigger cities, migration, internal migration would keep going towards the central suburbs. So the very, very distant suburbs in any big city, I think, will soon experience similar dynamics to what the smaller villages and townships are experiencing. Meaning COVID did give us a little bit of a pause in that people did want to, you know, companies did want to relocate a little bit away from the city centers. They set up satellite offices as opposed to one big headquarters in the center of the city, but that's kind of gone. And now we're seeing movement again towards the central suburbs of every big city. And so I think those locations, so if up until, let's say, 5-7 years ago, we were looking at which cities are gaining in population, these days, almost all prefectures are no longer gaining in population. And what we're looking at now is which wards within the cities are the ones that are becoming more popular. When it comes to a city that still has room to grow, for example, Fukuoka City is just geographically in such a position that to the east, west, and south, north, we got the ocean, but east, west, and south, we've got long stretches of train line that just goes across houses and fields. So as the central wards become more popular, we do have room for urban rejuvenation projects on the next station down the line kind of thing, which we're seeing now. So each city is its own story. Each city has its own dynamics at the moment. The wards are not a unified picture. Tokyo especially is very all over the place. It's a very fragmented market. There are some central wards or towns within Tokyo within the various municipalities in Tokyo that are more central but less popular, and others that are more suburban but becoming a lot more popular. So the picture is becoming a bit more granular as the population trend continues to play out.
Yeah, speaking of Tokyo, you know, I was really surprised. Like 2 years ago, I haven't been to Odaiba for a while, but as you mentioned, so there is a dynamic there. And when I came to Japan in 2001, so Odaiba was such a vibrant place to be, right, and to visit, because I guess it was still new. I don't know. I don't remember when it was built, but I guess it was built more than maybe 40 or 50 years ago. But back then, in 2001, right, it was very vibrant. It was very crowded on holidays, on weekends, and even during the week. And then just 2 years ago, when I went there with my friend, and then the city was so quiet. There were so few people. I was thinking, it's really fascinating because that city, which was really so popular, suddenly became a quiet one. And then the crowds, obviously the next generation of Tokyoites, moved to other places. They prefer to enjoy other places, other areas of Tokyo now. And I thought, how short-lived, really, popularity can be, even for, locations, right, and venues and so on. So I think in what you said in the beginning, at the end of the day, it's still a gamble, but you can gamble with a higher level of certainty, right, of positive results if you really have or analyze the situation and have some.
Yes, and always from my perspective, the monthly paycheck is the main indicator. I'm not going to be personally, well, again, we have clients who do different things, but personally, I would not be investing in a property that doesn't generate a stable, reliable monthly income. I can settle for a slightly lower yield in exchange for something that I think has potential growth. But if the monthly paycheck, the rental yield is not there, I don't tend to invest personally, because I don't, any kind of growth or non-growth potential capital expansion can be icing on the cake, but it needs to be based in fundamentals, which means monthly paychecks. So even if that location doesn't do so well in 5 years' time, I've still gained 5 years of nice rental profits, and then I can sell off the property at a slightly lower price. I'm still well in the green.
Right. Okay. And speaking of which, I also wonder what kind of investments, what is really a good project to invest into? Because you mentioned already the hospitality infrastructure, for example, but what else? Because it couldn't be only hospitality, right? There are, I believe, other opportunities for investing here in Japan.
From a real estate perspective, if you're going to be running the property yourself, then your basic long-term lease, residential or commercial, is your best bet, because you're having a tenant in place, you have somebody serving them, there's a property manager, but it's really a matter of collecting the rent, handling any maintenance or complaints, which is rare with Japanese tenants, and then if and when they move out, replace them with a new tenant, and then it's set and forget again for a number of years. If you personally have experience with anything else, then you could definitely look into hospitality properties, but then you have to be a lot more hands-on. So you're working with a short-term stay hospitality property manager, but you have to know how to judge their work. You have to constantly look together with them at what the competition is doing, occupancy rates, vacancy rates. There are experts in this field who have manuals upon manuals of how to fine-tune and tweak a hospitality property. If you want to get into anything that's more industry specific, like aged care facilities, data center facilities, logistics facilities, those again are all out there, but you need to know what you're doing, because you're going to be working with operators. Again, assuming you're not here yourself and setting up a project with your expertise on your own, you're going to be working with operators, and you need to know how to judge their performance. You need to know how to push and prod them when they're not doing the best job. You need to know when to replace them with another operator, and that all takes expertise. So if you don't have it, I would stick to the long-term residential and commercial market, where you have a tenant renting out the place. When they move out, you replace them with another tenant and so forth.
I see. So that's a rather complicated process, isn't it?
Which and one?
I mean, all those basically finding the people who can, understand how to do all the things that you do.
The more creative stuff, yes. The alternative investments. Yes, yes, definitely out there. Like we regularly have people contacting us and saying, hey, I want to have a share house near a university. Share house property managers are rare and far between. We have to find the good ones in each particular location. If they exist, we have to learn how to work with them, and we have to have somebody to replace them with if they don't do a good job. So from our perspective, it takes a lot of research. And then if and when trouble arises, we have a much more limited pool of professionals to yield to when we need to get something done. So the more creative you get, I'd say the higher the risk factor, but also the higher the potential rewards. We're happy to accommodate any request, but we are not the experts on any industry. We have to work with the professionals, and we have to research who those professionals are.
Right. Yes. And so basically, I also wanted to ask you another question, because we touched upon IKEA, but we know that there are also a lot of other properties that are not newly built. So what do people invest in, or what would you recommend, and also what would you recommend them to invest in? New buildings or new infrastructure, or something that is has already been there for a while?
From return on investment and ROI and yield perspective, the sweet spot for concrete buildings, so if you're buying an entire concrete building, if you have the budget for it, or a condo unit in a concrete building, we would say that the sweet spot for yield, without getting too much of a hassle and losing value too quickly, is somewhere between 20 to 30 years of age. If you buy much younger than 20, then the yield will be much lower. If you buy much older than 30, then the value will fall off a cliff very quickly, because the property takes a lot more renovations and repairs as it approaches 40. And for wooden structures, I would go 20 years and younger. So 10 to 20 at most. For the same reason, younger would be lower yield, and over 20 is when wooden structures start accumulating more maintenance issues. So you want to buy them at 20 and resell them closer to 30, and with concrete, you want to buy them at 30 or younger and resell them closer to 40. Mm-hmm. But houses tend to be a bit of a headache in Japan. I wouldn't classify wooden houses as the ideal asset for investment purposes.
I think that many people misunderstand this, that when you have a house, you have made a better investment, because basically the wooden building, as you say, No, they devaluate much faster, right? So, and I don't know what is the average lifespan of residential wooden houses, but it's not really that long here in Japan.
From a tax perspective, they completely depreciate at 23 years old. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that they're actually physically worthless. You can definitely keep a house alive and maintained longer than that, but once they hit about 35, 40, you're going to be pouring money into them on a far more regular basis. Mm-hmm. And beyond 50, is even 45, I would say, is really time to consider to demolish and rebuild them. Unless if they're, you know, a phenomenal 200-year-old kominka in the countryside that's been lovingly restored, and you're opened because they were actually built to last a lot better in those days, right? The ones with the huge mm-hmm. pillars that you see in the countryside, like mini temples, those are built much sturdier. So those you can continue to restore and maintain, and they will be beautiful houses that have a lot of value. But then you need specific artisans, which are also dying out. That's another another part where the population issue comes in, is that there are less and less people who know how to maintain these kinds of properties. And it's very expensive to maintain these kinds of properties. So they last longer, but if and when you do need to do work on them, it's a lot more expensive. So generally, and everything modern built post-World War II is not meant to last. So with wooden houses, if you're buying them brand new, or let's say 10 to 20 years old, they could be, but they're also family sized, meaning you have to get a family tenant to put in there. And again, population trend being the way it is, it's a lot easier to find singles and couples without children, or maybe with one child. So much smaller footprint, not a single family home, but rather a maybe two bedroom condo unit, or between mm-hmm. a studio to a two bedroom, is a lot easier to populate, and a lot less of a floor plan to renovate between tenants as well. So we would normally, unless somebody has a specific reason to go for single family homes, we'd normally direct them towards condo units.
I see. Well, and that's also a very important insight, because I believe that if you don't know the market very well, if you don't have people like you who can help with all those trends, I think it's easy, really very easy to make an investment, I would say, investment which doesn't really yield.
That's half the reason for our existence there, yeah.
Right.
Half of it is to bridge the cultural and language gap. And to provide people with a remote presence in Japan that they can be their single point of contact. And the other half is to give them exactly this kind of advice.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku, or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
If you want to enjoy the best of both worlds and you have the budget for it, then I would buy a aparto, right? Like a small multi-unit. It is wood or steel framed wood, but it's built a lot sturdier than a single family home. They start at very low prices compared to Western markets. So you can, you know, good location, decent age aparto can start at around 40, 50 million yen, which is about 300 or 350,000 US dollars. And you get a multi-unit two or three floor apartment building with somewhere between 4 to 12 units in a decent location. Then you have the benefit of owning the entire land plot, which is larger than what you'd get with the fraction that you get with a condo. You have a diverse income stream. One tenant moves out, you've still got 4 or 5 units generating income. And that tends to be a better investment. And also you're not dependent on owner union rules. You can maybe experiment with short-term stays, monthly stays. You don't have to ask permission. Except for the local municipality, you still have to fall within zoning regulations. But other than that, you can do what you want with the property. It gives you more flexibility, more creative freedom, more diversity. But then maintenance of the entire structure is on you. So you need to have not only the capital to buy in, but also the capital to put aside to constantly maintain and renovate the property when it needs attention.
Right. I was not aware that those... their houses, right? Their wooden constructions. I was not aware that they were called aparto, because for me, aparto usually means a condo in a block of flats, which is
an apartment in India. So that's something that's confusing to a lot of our,
right?
Our clients.
It is.
So yes. An apartment in English is an apartment, is a condo unit within a larger.
Right.
But
yeah.
In Japan, the small wooden structures that are multi-unit apartment buildings are called aparto.
Oh, I was not aware of that. And well, we learn something new every day.
Right? The big concrete building, the units are called mansions.
They are, yes, in Japan.
Or mansion. a mansion room. The whole building is called a mansion. And one of the units in the condo is a room in the mansion.
Yes, okay.
Whereas in English, where when I say mansion, somebody's imagining like a Hollywood celebrity type house on a hill,
right,
in Hollywood.
So right. Or an English mansion in a countryside.
Or an English manor, yeah, exactly.
Manor in the countryside, yes. Right. So it's interesting also how these terms travel across borders, right? And how they change their meaning. Right. And then you mentioned also, if you are the sole proprietor or the owner of such a building, for example, inevitably you cannot or it is not recommended that you invest all the free cash you have into it, right? Because you need some cash to be left in case that you need some repairs.
You always need. So if you're buying a mansion room or a condo unit or an apartment, then you're paying a monthly fee to the owner union and the building management company, and they put aside reserve funds. Hopefully they put aside reserve funds. That's part of the due diligence we do, is to make sure that they have kept what they need to aside.
Right. Yeah.
And then whenever there's any structural work that needs to be done, then they will be paying for it out of the reserve funds. They will be planning for it ahead, and you don't need to worry about putting money aside. Aside from sprucing up the interior or paying some vacancy expenses between tenants, but those are relatively lower amounts. When you own the entire structure, there's nobody collecting any monthly fees and putting them aside. You need to do that. You need to have the discipline and the reserve funds on your own, so that you have, I don't know, 10% of the rental income that you put aside. And if and when something needs to be done on the structure, then you have the capital to repair it.
Right. It sounds like an amortization fee. Is that what they call it in business?
I think that's
right.
Or, operating capital, or I don't know, depends on the industry you're in.
Yeah. It depends indeed. But yeah, monthly 10% of the income that you generate. But then how much, before you start generating that income after you have made the investment, before that, how much cash is usually good to have left free just in case there is need of some urgent repairs, let's say, after you have invested?
We tell our clients, our clients normally, if they're not living in Japan, they don't have a bank account here. They can't open a bank account here. So we are managing their funds for them. And then they tell us when to remit their income back home. We tell them always to leave at least $1,000 or $2,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 yen here in case there's anything urgent that needs to be. If it's bigger than that, then you'll need to remit funds into Japan anyway.
Right.
But if it's small annoying stuff that would cost up to $1,000-$2,000, then you don't want to suddenly have to remit tiny amounts at whatever exchange rates are available at that moment. So it's always good to have per unit under management, it's good to have about $1,000-$2,000 here. So if you own the entire building and it has 6 units, maybe times 6 is not a bad idea.
Right, I see. Yeah, because sometimes, once again, you mentioned the dreamers in the beginning, and I believe that in many cases it's like go all in. Right.
Yes, yeah. That's one of the first conversations we have with people. If their entire budget is that studio condo unit for $30,000, mm-hmm. I would not want to see them spending their entire life savings on that. I would want them to have something else that they're invested in. So, again, part of the initial conversation, onboarding conversation we have with potential clients is, what else are you invested in? What kind of asset class? Where in the world do you have stocks? Do you have anything that's more liquid? Do you have anything that's more speculative? And then we try to make recommendation based on that. If somebody comes up to us with their entire life savings, whether it's for an Akiya holiday home or an investment property, I would recommend that they save a bit more and have a bit more liquidity before they pull the trigger.
Right. Yeah, that's a good piece of advice, I believe. And then also another thing. So many people come here, or before they come to Japan, they contact you and they say, okay, I want to invest and so on. So what questions do you think they should ask you first? And it is, not to check your expertise, but for their own clarification. So things that they have to know, they need to be aware of. What questions should they ask themselves? What questions should they ask you so that they can get that clearer picture in their heads?
Well, from a self-awareness perspective, they should be aware of why they're investing. What are their investment goals? Mm-hmm. What are they looking to purchase? And similarly, if it's not an investment, if they're looking for a piece of Japan, a corner of Japan to call their own as a holiday home, they should be aware of what sort of lifestyle would be suitable for them. So a lot of people are chasing the dream. If they're investing in a Japanese holiday home, then they have a Studio Ghibli kind of version in their head of what a beautiful anime style house in the countryside might look and feel like to live in. If they're looking for investment, then they might have preconceived perceptions of what a good investment is that they bring in from their home country. So the first question that they should ask is to present us with their view, their goals, their image, and then allow us to tell them if that's even feasible in Japan. Sometimes there are slight tweaks needed. Sometimes we have to completely burst their bubble and tell them that what they're imagining is not feasible at all. So first, know thyself is the mantra. And then from then on, they need to be aware. I mean, they wouldn't. It's a tricky question for me because they usually don't know what questions to ask. So we have to kind of preempt a lot of things that we are already aware of is a preconception and tell them how tenancy laws work in Japan, what sort of properties tend to make for better investments, what sort of locations tend to be more attractive, buying in super central location. I mean, everything that we discussed in our first conversation that people are not aware of that are counterintuitive. I don't expect them to know that. What I do expect them to be is open to learning about things that might be different to what they're assuming.
Right. And also, I have another question. when it comes to investment here? Because sometimes if you are a Japanese resident and if you are a business here, right, you can borrow money, bank money, and invest them. And so you can pay off the debt later on. Because, well, with the income that comes from that investment. But then when you work with foreign residents, and do Japanese banks actually lend money to foreigners to invest?
Foreign residents who are resident in Japan, and that's an important point that people overlook, also generate their income in Japan. So if you're a foreign resident, but your entire income is generated in the USA, then you don't qualify. But if you're a foreign resident here generating an income in Japan, either from your own business or as a salaried employee, and salaried employees are usually the ones that find it easier to get loans, then yes, Japanese lenders would lend to you. They would want to see that you're either a permanent resident or at least on a clear route towards permanent residency, which is becoming a bit more of a vague route these days, but it could potentially still be the case. If you're a non-resident of Japan, your options are a lot more limited. So there are a few banks that would lend for investment properties, whether those are condo units or entire buildings, but you can't. It's difficult to work with them directly. You would have to work with a company that specializes and has the connections with these lenders and can help you get that kind of loan by establishing a Japanese corporate entity, which is, you know, comes with an upkeep of a good few thousand dollars a year. So I wouldn't do it for a cheaper condo unit. It's just not worth it. But they are, that is possible. Alternatively, there's a new company called Yen Loans that have been in business for about a year now, and they provide loans for condo units anywhere in Japan, and they will potentially down the track be expanding to houses as well for any kind of purpose, whether it's a holiday home, an investment property, or just, you know, even if you've got an existing asset in Japan, you can withdraw the from the equity that they, you have on this asset, and then you can get a loan to do anything you want. But both of these solutions, as well as the banks that do lend to non-resident foreigners by establishing a corporation in Japan, all of these are not going to be at the same terms that a Japanese resident would get. So the interest rate would be higher. You'd be a lot more limited in the types of properties that you can borrow for and the types of purposes that you're going to use them for. And there's a handful of options, not a multitude and hundreds of institutions like a Japanese resident would have.
Right. So it's not an easy option to go for.
For non-residents, no, but there are options out there, yeah, that, which was not the case up until about 5 years ago, so it's actually an improvement.
I see, okay. And then, so my next question to you is, for people, for foreigners, okay, who have come here on, let's say, on a five-year visa, because they're five-year visas, right? So, and...
Working visa, you're
working visa, yes, yes. And of course, they generate income here, but you know, they don't know basically whether they will be able to stay after the first 5 years, or they'll have to go back. So, what would you?
Most lenders would not lend to them. Those foreign-specific, non-resident-specific lenders would, but again, that would be at the same terms that a non-resident would get.
Okay, and to such people, would you recommend buying or renting?
Depending on where and what they can buy, if they can, so most expats like to live in much better locations and wider, more comfortable properties than your typical Japanese tenants. If that's what you're going to be getting, I would advise to rent, because that doesn't translate into a good investment property down the track. You're going to be in a central location, a large property, relatively new building, the yield would be very low. So when you move out and you put a tenant in there, you're going to make peanuts compared to the price that you purchased it for. But if they're the more down-to-earth types and they're okay living a little bit suburban in a little bit of an older building with a smaller footprint, house or condo unit, then I'd say buying does make sense, because then when you move out and you put a tenant in there, you're getting a decent yield, and it's worth it.
To me, that's counterintuitive, honestly. And of course, I think it is so because I don't work in your industry.
Well, I mean, if you're buying in super central Tokyo, Tokyo, Osaka, or Fukuoka, then your condo unit will probably gain in value in 5 or 10 years' time. So there are edge cases where that does become a worthy proposition when you're buying something very expensive. But for most of us who operate in the middle ground, I would say we always tell people that the type of property that you'd ideally want to live in doesn't make for the best investment, and vice versa. The best investment property you'd probably never want to live in because they're going to be small and cramped and uncomfortable and not in the best location, which is where we get the cash cows to generate the highest yield. So yes, a little bit counterintuitive, yeah.
That's interesting too. Okay, another piece of gold here.
Yeah, well, we can go on for days, right?
We can go on for days. I would love to continue the conversation, of course, because there is so much that people like me don't know. And I have been here for 25 years and still have close to no idea how things work in the real estate area. So fascinating. And then I have also a question to you. So you came to Japan like 15 years ago, I think you mentioned that, right?
Yes, that's right.
So what one thing actually turned your, let's say, perspective or your understanding of how Japan works in, or how real estate in Japan works? What is that one thing that turned, you know, upside down your understanding of the industry here in Japan as compared to industries in other countries?
Yeah, I think the first penny drop for me, and that's something we touched on in our previous conversation, is that what we mentioned earlier is that the fact that I'm a cash buyer and have money to invest doesn't mean that I'm in any superior position here, right? So being a foreigner plays a much stronger role than being a cash buyer in Japan. The reluctance to work with us, as opposed to the wish to get our money and get our deal, they run counterintuitive again to what you would be the case in other countries. So you have to, and still we have buyers to this day who come in and think that they can boss around the agents that they're working with and send them on wild errands and fool's runs and expect them to do stuff that, because they are the buyer, they are the customer, and we have to very quickly, it's not nice to say, but very quickly put them in their place and explain to them that if they keep communicating with their professionals this way, they're not going to have any professionals to work with. We've got thick skin and we work with foreigners on a daily basis, but your traditional Japanese real estate agent will only take so much of that before they disappear. So that was a big eye-opener for me, but fortunately I learned quickly.
So can we say that the real estate industry here is like a fortress and the agents are the guardians?
That's a bit extreme. It is getting better these days. There are a lot more agents, especially younger ones and especially women who are generally more open-minded in Japan, who are looking to work with foreigners. They realize that their local market is shrinking and they need to go to a foreign clientele if they want to expand their businesses. And also they're just more internationally savvy. Maybe they studied overseas, they visited a lot, they like what they felt with on a business perspective, and they want to do that kind of business. So it's not as impenetrable as it used to be. But you can't come in all guns blazing and waltzing around and expecting things to work the way they do in your home country. It's a very different market here.
Right. So I have, okay, my next question, of course, is to anybody who watches us and who is thinking of investing in Japan. So where can they find you? And do you also work across Japan, or do you focus mostly on Fukuoka? So these are two different.
No. We're in Fukuoka because we love the city. When we first started around 15 years ago, this was where the best deals were at. These days, Fukuoka has become more similar to Osaka price-wise. It's not as attractive as it used to be, but we still love it, so we're still living here. We work nationwide, and finding me is so easy because that name, there's only one of me. So anywhere on social media, you'll run a search for Ziv Nakajima again. You should be able to find me. Our website is nippontradings.com, NIPPON tradings with an S.com, all one word. And the Japan Real Estate Podcast, if you Google that on Spotify or Apple Store, wherever you're listening to podcasts, there's only one Japan Real Estate Podcast. And that's got all our contact details there. And it's worth a listen because it goes through a lot of the stuff that we've been discussing here in a lot more detail.
Right. Well, thank you for that, because I believe that Japan will continue to be an attractive investment spot. Can I call this this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, because
just for different reasons. Just be aware
for different reasons. Yes.
It's attractive, but not for the reasons you might think.
Right. Well, maybe we can explore those reasons in a different conversation later on when your time, your work schedule allows. And then at this point of time, I want to say thank you to you and really for sharing all those nuggets of gold. Because once again, for people who haven't been here, people like me who have been here for such a long time have no idea, and all these things, they feel counterintuitive, right? So it's definitely worth just working with people like you is what I want to say. And of course, I also want to say that I'm grateful that you shared that with us here for everybody.
Well, thank you. Hear. I appreciate it. If this brings value to anyone and helps them from some costly mistakes, then my mission is accomplished.
Yeah, and also to everybody watching, please do not hesitate to reach out to Ziv, because you can find him on social media very easily, his name and also his company as well. Predominantly, not only LinkedIn, right? You're on Facebook, I believe. You're also on...
Yes. I'm personally active on Facebook, LinkedIn, and I do reply on Instagram as well. I'm there, but it kind of mirrors my Facebook. I'm not super active there. And okay. The company is everywhere. The company is on, it has company pages on Facebook and LinkedIn as well. It's on TikTok. It's on, I think I'm even on Threads, I believe. I don't know. We have a social media.
Right.
It used to be me, but I'm not in the loop anymore.
Yeah, I think that the easiest way is just to type in your name and go from
yes,
there.
Yes, definitely. Right. Yeah, I'm very easily found and approachable.
Thank you, Ziv. So I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation, and to everybody who watched us today, have a great midweek and a reminder of the week as well. See you next time.
See you.
Yeah, so hope this was as good for you as it was for me. Definitely one of my favorite conversations on the podcast since we kicked it off 9 years ago now. I love it when someone asks all of the right questions and is really eager to learn. And Maya is, if anything, in spite of being a leading expert in her own right, the perfect listener and interviewer. I absolutely adore speaking to her, and I hope to speak to her again in the near future. Now, we can't let you go without telling you about MailMate, our sponsors and business partners. They offer peace of mind for your property in Japan. They'll make sure that your taxes, your utility bills are all paid on time, liaise with your management company for you, or assist with your parcel delivery while you're out of town. Get in touch with them on mailmate.jp today and mention the Japan Real Estate Podcast for 10% off your first year. And that's it from us for this episode, folks. Huge thank you for tuning in. Please do follow and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening, and we'd love it if you could like and even share this episode with anyone you think might find interest in it. But even more importantly, we love hearing from you. So please let us know what you thought about this episode or the podcast overall in the comments section here on our social media channels. We've got a very active Facebook group and business page, both under the name Japan Real Estate on Facebook. And that's also the name and URL of our YouTube channel if you'd like to follow us there, Japan Real Estate on YouTube as well. And we'd of course appreciate your rating or review on Spotify or on the Apple Store or wherever you're tuning in from. Hope to have you with us again. Have a great rest of the day or night ahead. よろしく。